there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, and by a longtime co-host, but he's been missing for a while.
Because he moved, it's his fault.
Dr. Adam Francisco. Now, Adam, you've been gone long enough that you need to introduce yourself to listeners we've picked up over the last, you know, year. So, who are you? Where have you been? Why? And are you happy to be back?
I'm nobody. Who are you? That's an Emily Dickinson poem. Who am I? I'm Adam Francisco. We started this podcast, was it 5 years ago now?
No, almost seven.
Almost seven.
Oh, wow. Okay, almost 7 years ago now. And I think, was it for 4 years? I was on it. Your dad and I were sitting at lunch, I believe, at Concordia University in Irvine, California. And we said we should start a podcast, which is kind of funny because both of us are, I don't know that we're Luddites.
We didn't know how to start a podcast.
Yeah, we didn't even know. New people were doing podcasts.
I had heard of a podcast.
But we did it, and we met for over a year in the garage, in San Juan Capistrano, where you'd sometimes hear helicopters from Camp Pendleton flying overhead,
often,
or the train.
You'd often hear gardeners.
You would gardeners often hear gardeners.
Whacking and yeah. And then that first year-ish, we were doing, we went through Philip Melanchthon's Loci, so basically the common places of theology, common doctrines. And then we took on all sorts of other topics. We moved to San Clemente to a recording studio there with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt. We've had all sorts of guests. And of course, Caleb, you've been here all along. You're the, I don't know if I want to say the brains behind it because I don't want your head to get too big, but you're
the glue.
You're the one who makes the magic happen.
Yeah.
You push buttons.
Although, Adam, you're almost like graduated to audio engineer now.
Yes.
Yeah. I received a little box in the mail the other week that has is this a soundboard, Caleb?
You can call it a soundboard.
Wires into and talk into. So.
Right. Yeah.
So that's, and I'm also, so I live in Chicago. I work at Concordia University in Chicago. I'm the dean of the College of Theology, Arts, and Humanities. As well as, and I got to take a deep breath, assistant provost of mission, that is institutional mission and identity here.
Anything else? So. I mean, I know university titles can get very long. I'm sure you have another title.
Professor of history.
There you go. there it is.
People will hear us. I suspect that we're going to be doing this again long term, right?
Yes.
Now that I have.
Yeah, yeah.
Now that we're able to do this remotely. My running joke is, it's not a joke because it's not funny, but I'm a historian, not a theologian. I do have a background in theology, though, so I know a few things, but nothing like what Scott knows when it comes to the finer things of theology.
Yeah. I mean, help transition us into our topic today, which is that we are going to, for the next couple of weeks, talk about C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien and the Inklings in general, and Lewis... probably, you know, he had access to that same out that you did, Adam. He could, you know, say
he was a layman.
I'm a professor of literature, and I'm just a layman doing theology.
You can write Mere Christianity and go, but I'm a layman.
Yeah,
so.
Layman's theology.
I'll leave it to the theologians.
Yeah. Well, and also with being a layman means you're not subject to ecclesiastical authorities, too.
Yeah, that's
although
nice.
That's certainly your case, Scott. Not so much my case, though.
Yeah.
Working
well,
at an
institution. Well, actually, that'd be reversed, even though you would say I'm the theologian on the show. I'm not called to any particular church body, so.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. We should get going on this topic, and we've been thinking about this for a while. I have at least, because we get common listener requests to cover this topic again. And the reason I say again is Adam was referencing, we've been doing the show for quite a while, and during that time we've gone through a handful of series. One of those was essentially Great Thinkers in the Christian Church. Mm-hmm. We did that, and Lewis was one of the later episodes in that. We actually sort of started in the early church and we moved forward. It was one of those ones where we had a little bit of organizational structure to those, and Lewis came up and then somehow became our most popular episode ever. Still to this day, if you search Apple Podcasts and you just type in C.S. Lewis, the Thinking Fellows pops up right at the top. It's been
So everybody go to Apple Podcasts and type in C.S. Lewis, because we could use the traffic.
And if you haven't, if you're a newer listener and you haven't listened to that one, if you do that, it would both probably be a good episode for you to enjoy and learn something from. But also it helps bump those search results and put our shows sort of back in the top listings on Apple Podcasts. And we really do appreciate that. But we've been asked to revisit that. And part of that is we covered as much as we could get in about Lewis into a compact 40-minute episode on it, right? And so, and then it's been years, and people go, "Wow, I really enjoyed that episode. I wish they would talk about it again." And then we've had people request that we move on to something like Tolkien as well. So there's convenient timing for this as well. We've been doing a series on the Lutheran Confessions since the beginning of this year. We've just been reading through the Articles of the Confessions. We started with the Catechisms, and now we just finished Smalcald a week ago. And so now we can take a little break, and we can do, I think, about a month-long series here before we pick that back up again. And so, yeah, there's just good timing. And then, as Adam pointed out, actually, to us this week, there was a movie. A documentary or a docudrama probably is the right way to
call it. I think they called it a one-man show.
Okay.
Although there was more than one man in it.
Called The Most Reluctant Convert, and that will be the title of this episode. And it's basically a visual biography of Lewis's life set in Lewis' own words.
Right.
And it was great. And so we went and viewed that after Adam told us about it. We made the drive down the mountain. And you said in your talk at Here We Still Stand that when you go see Christian media, you're usually pretty skeptical before you go.
Skeptical because I usually dislike it.
And I was kind of skeptical because, thinking about the Tolkien movie last year, there was not much in there about him being a devout Catholic.
Right.
We knew that this Lewis movie was going to focus on his conversion, on his Christian theology and experience. That made me worried in the other direction, right? Which is providing sort of a overly religious picture of things. And it wasn't that at all.
It was interesting.
An airbrushed version.
An airbrushed version.
It's like the cover of some of his books over the years. You know, there's been all sorts of covers. There's one fairly famous one where he's sitting there, and I guess in the original he's got a cigarette in his in hand. And if you look at the history of that cover art, there are times where it's been brushed out, and And I think it was Alistair McGrath, when he was talking about C.S. Lewis once, talks about the history of his reception. He makes the point that he's not that widely read, or hasn't been, at least in the past, in England, but American evangelicals love him, except for those that tend towards a fundamentalism, because he smoked and drank. They don't like him that much. And so you're probably concerned that the evangelicals were going to turn him into something he was not.
Yeah, because I don't know. I didn't know anything about the production going in beforehand.
I still don't. Even though, before the movie started, they did a 15-minute kind of like how the movie was made type introduction, and they talked about the importance of Lewis's conversion. But even the introduction by the people who made the movie about why the movie was made wasn't overly Christian introduction.
No, there was one. There were two individuals who seemed to care specifically about that point in the movie, and that was the actor who played Lewis seemed to care, and then there was a production staff member that they were interviewing who also, it seemed like, provided some of the biographical sort of weight to the film.
That was the way it was advertised too. Is that it was something the trailer says, has Lewis, the person playing Lewis, say something like, "You've all heard about Chronicles of Narnia and those sorts of stories, but the story you've not heard much about is my life and my conversion to Christianity." And so
that makes the subtitle make sense, because we, having been aware of Lewis's works, the entirety of them, right? And we've covered his apologetic work and some of his other sort of theological assertions. It was surprising to me when the subtitle of the film was The Untold Story of C.S. Lewis. But I suppose you're right that if you're talking about the the general American audience who's watched the Chronicle of Narnia's movies, because let's be honest, nobody reads anymore, right? They don't, you know, they don't know Lewis as a sort of lay theologian.
Well, and they don't know him as a non-Christian, I think is the point. Mm-hmm. Like, even if you're aware of C.S. Lewis, you know C.S. Lewis as the great apologist, maybe, or as the author of the Chronicles of Narnia, which are obviously Christian tales. But I don't, I would bet that even most people who have read some Lewis don't really understand that for a good portion of his adult life, he was a non-Christian. I mean, a good portion of even his professional life, or at least a portion of his professional life, he was a non-Christian, and that it was by means of some reading, for sure, but mostly his relationship with other faculty friends at Oxford that sort of brought him around. They kept challenging him. And that's one of the things I loved the most about the portrayal of the movie, because I think it's something that is so lacking in our culture, is that just for people who haven't seen it, and maybe people who have read Surprised by Joy, if you've read Surprised by Joy, you will recognize large swaths of that movie. You will hear Surprised by Joy quite a bit as the main character, Lewis, is reciting whole sections out of Surprised by Joy. But they do a very good job of even portraying like how his actual formal education didn't really proceed much until his father sent him off to study with the great Nock, who basically challenged every assertion that he made from the minute he got off the train. You know, I thought the weather would be different here. And he's like, what grounds did you have for believing the weather would be different here? What grounds did you have for believing anything about here? Have you ever been here? And he just sort of, it's a challenge. And then even as they portray sort of his conversations, I think mostly with Owen Barfield and J.R.R. Tolkien in the movie, yep. No one in that group let anyone else in that group get away with anything. And that's how their conversations proceeded. And that's how Lewis became a Christian. I mean, Lewis became a Christian by his friends challenging every materialist assumption that would come out of his mouth. And we just don't do that anymore. In fact, we think it's rude. We think it's...
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Unhelpful. We think it's whatever.
Is that the behavior that you saw amongst his closest friends, and biographically, that's pretty accurate portrayal, that it was... His basically Barfield, his brother Warney, and Tolkien, who were his closest friends in life, and his friends adamantly disagreed with him on what we would today call his worldview.
Right.
We are used to cultivating friendships around total agreement on every issue, right?
Well, we're
or
used to cultivate
things. Yeah.
Niceties.
Beer or sports. Not that those are bad things. In fact, the former is very good. But we had an episode on friendship, I think, years ago, Scott, when we talked about the Inklings and the friendship that was in that particular group of people there at Oxford. And I still remember. I don't remember the conversation we had so much, but I remember how. This is going to sound kind of strange, but I remember how I felt. When you were, because you're the one who know this, even though I'm the historian, you know the history of Lewis like no other, at least no other person I know, and that's not to stroke your ego, but but I remember feeling, gosh, I want that, the movie, you see it right in the trailer, just and Scott, you were at Oxford, and I spent a little time there too, and it just takes you there, and you can just. Yeah. Feel it, like what it must have been like for these guys sitting around the pub table. They loved each other so much so that they're concerned about each other and what they thought was true and good and beautiful and so on and so forth.
And
just an incredible thing.
That concern comes out in Surprised by Joy. And another place that concern really comes out is in McGrath's biography of Lewis. The concern that his friends had for him when he was a non-Christian. especially concerns of one of the bigger disappointments about the movie was what a small part in the movie Warney Lewis played, except for the portrayal of them two.
In childhood.
But they didn't really portray him at all as an adult living in the same house as Lewis for most of their lives. And sort of the interaction that they had. They portrayed, you know, Tolkien, which was kind of cool.
Tolkien as a Christian on screen was like a great
counter to the movie,
which, you know,
was a love story.
was a love story, and probably helped people who just want to just enjoy the Lord of the Rings as a pure fantasy.
Yeah.
Really just get attached to him in a romanticized way, right? This was, I mean, Tolkien. They had him providing sort of, like, not only is theism important, but actually talking about the person of and work of Christ to Lewis on film was great. Yeah. Was fantastic.
So I was going to say, Adam, since you're here and you can do it, and I don't have to, Caleb and I won't have to do it. In the movie, Lewis... the Lewis character mentions many times he's a materialist. And I don't think everybody that goes to see the movie is going to understand what that means from sort of like a 20th century academic saying, I'm a materialist. What did he mean by that?
Well, really great question, because it's, you know, that term, at least in the academic world, is thrown around quite a bit, but it means different things to different people. But in Lewis's context, so first half of the 20th century, maybe very tail end of the 19th century, materialism is all but synonymous with atheism. It's a worldview that says all that exists is matter, energy, space, and time, material stuff. You know, it's like, think of, do you remember the old show that Carl Sagan used to do called Cosmos?
Yeah.
I think,
billions and billions of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On PBS. Now, I think it's Neil deGrasse Tyson does it, a new version, but in the Sagan one, it would start off, the cosmos is all there is, was, never shall be.
Right.
And
paid for by your tax dollars.
Yes, indeed.
Don't worry, that's a proper separation of church and state.
So that's it. Materialism is like the real spirit of what we might call modernism. You know, that, I guess, I don't know how much of a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, but certainly, probably, he was probably a little older than C.S. Lewis, if memory serves me correctly, or maybe a little, well, Scott, you can correct me, Wittgenstein, Ludwig Wittgenstein, you know? At Cambridge University, started the first line in his it's a slim volume, but all the historians of ideas say this was like essential. It was a turning point in the history of ideas in the West. It's a work called the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, and the first line is, "The universe is all that is the case."
Yeah,
And that's materialism. That is, there's nothing outside, beyond, before. All there is this material stuff. And knowledge is only obtained by exploring material stuff. Anything above that, anything like morality, anything that might be immaterial, is, as it would have been put at Oxford at the time by people like A.J. Ayer and these, you know, the Anglo tradition of analytic philosophy is just meaningless metaphysics or meaningless God talk.
That they were really sick of, to sort of ascribe some psychology to them that they were just really tired of having to deal with.
Yeah. So, that's kind of it in a nutshell. I know that was a little more than a nutshell, but it's scientific atheism or alleged scientific atheism.
And there's a kind of an irony to materialism, I think, where it's sort of an idea that's really sick of speculation, but takes sort of a lot of speculation to get into. So if you can speculate that this is all there is or ever could be, then you can operate here with a extreme lack of speculation and just sort of examine what you can know through your physical senses. But the problem is what it takes to get there is you have to just agree to some assumptions right off the bat that are speculative in nature. And I think that's one of the things that the movie actually did a pretty good job, without getting too technical, of presenting Lewis prior to being a believer as just sort of having no room for this anymore. Just, I have no room for it. Even the stuff that he was really drawn to, which the movie actually points out from Surprised by Joy, even the stuff that he was drawn to, the occult, at some point he had to sort of divest himself of it and just say, I don't have, we'd say this way, I think, I don't have bandwidth for that anymore.
Yeah. I think it's important to point out that his conversion is a sort of fall in from sort of nominal Christianity into atheism, not sort of like a Christianity which has any understanding or, you know, grounds.
Well, obligatory Christianity.
Yeah, and I would say that makes up so many people that I talk to in my generation who say they are not Christians anymore, or say they are kind of Christian but not whatever they grew up as. And there were, you know, striking quotes that do come from his works, like that he believed God was a magician, essentially, right? That he wanted God to do things like magic, and in particular heal his mother, and then to be gone. He didn't want God around before his mother was sick. He didn't
need to show up for the birthday party, do his tricks, and then go home.
He didn't need God after his mother was sick. Yeah. He needed God to do this one thing and then be gone.
On demand.
And I think about the amount of, part of this runs into that section of the book, was followed by excerpts from The Problem of Pain and sort of his fall into atheism.
Which, by the way, is not a very broadly read work of Lewis, but actually one of the better small works of Lewis, The Problem of Pain. The other one that they quoted in here with The Way to Glory, also probably not very often read, but in a Christian world, struggling to find sort of how do you value people while disagreeing with sort of their positions or lifestyle on things, you ought to read The Way to Glory for sort of an approach to that you can still honor people, as created in the image of God, while understanding that sort of there's a burden to be carried by carrying other sinful people around in this world.
Yeah. It made me think about the amount of people where Christianity is essentially an exchange. You do, and not an exchange as Lutherans usually think about too, where it's like God does some, you do some, you get saved. But an exchange literally, and like I do some things for God, like I pray at dinner, I show up to church, and you know, I'm good most of the time. And, that means when I'm in a real time of need, God will finally show up for me at some point. Mm-hmm. My dedication will be rewarded with dedication. My faithfulness will return his faithfulness, kind of thing. And for how many people, every day likely who have, you know, traded some things to God, does God not show up for the miracle here?
Yeah.
Right.
I think the portrayal of his childhood Christianity as obligatory Christianity was very good, which at the end led to the greatest scene in the movie, was the scene at the very end when he takes communion and the priest puts the wafer in his mouth and says, "The body of Christ given for you." And, you know, you can see the Lewis character. It's the sort of middle-aged, but not the child Lewis, not the older Lewis, but the sort of 30-year-old Lewis character playing it, is moved dramatically by that, because earlier when he was doing Christianity as an obligation as a child, he had taken communion
as an atheist
at 13 or whatever, as an atheist, and he calls that, he literally calls it
blasphemy,
his greatest sin. Like, and he describes some of his other sins, like he fell into sexual sin and to lust and yet he calls his greatest sin the time he took communion as an unbeliever. And I thought that was just like, for one, I thought it was amazing. Two, for a broadly evangelical audience, I think some follow-up reading may be in order on that.
Right. I thought there were a couple of things that, just as an attendee, were interesting to me. We're in Southern California, right? So in the parts of Southern California we're in, there are a lot of Christians, but most of them belong to big
Saddleback
evangelical
type,
yeah. churches, very large
Mariners,
institutional,
Saddleback.
Like big organizations, yeah. right? And you could tell at this showing that they showed up. A lot of them showed up. Yeah. In fact, there were the movie theater we went to originally had one screening listed. It sold out very quickly, and so they opened a second screening, which we were in.
Yeah, and I'd say if they're showing up because they're reading Lewis and they really want to see the deeper story, good on them for both reading Lewis and showing up.
But, you know, some things about the movie. Number one, we did the classical sort of Lutheran thing, and we went to the bar at the movie theater and got the beers to go in.
Before we went to the movie.
We went to the movie, we were like, the Lutherans have arrived.
Walking in with each one of us with a beer in each hand, being like... nobody else.
Which, by the way, was rewarded greatly when the Lewis character sits down at the pub and pours the audience a beer or slides a beer to the audience and says cheers. I was like, yeah, that's pretty amazing.
I was going to say this, though, Adam. I thought it was funny that the pub he went into, which I suppose was supposed to be like the Eagle and Child, you know, which is where the Inklings met. Wasn't the Eagle and Child. It was that White Horse Inn next to the Blackwell's Bookshop.
Oh, interesting.
Well, yeah. They said they had
to go there. I only know, I don't know, but I only know that there was that pub because
you've spent some time there.
Yeah, maybe. I maybe
yes.
have stumbled
had a hard,
out of there.
Hard time getting home.
Caleb, have you been to Oxford? Did you ever?
I did not. I went to England, I didn't have time to go to Oxford.
It's I mean, when you go there, if you know something about C.S. Lewis and his life, or Tolkien or whatever. It's just, you go to, is it Magdalen College, I think it was, where Addison's Walk is, where Lewis's, kind of where Lewis's conversion took place.
They show Addison's Walk in the movie.
Yeah. And you just get, you know, you go there and just, I don't know what it's like today, you know, maybe they're all woke there now, who knows, but you just get, it feels like a serious place, except for when they're taking tests and drinking afterwards, and people are laying around in the streets and so on, but just there's a...
To be fair to them, it's a totally different system, right? They get like all pent up with information for an entire semester that, you know, other than in tutorials, they don't really have any measurement of how much they're taking it in or not. Yeah. And then at the end of the semester, have to go to a specific spot, sit down, and write exams where they vomit out all the information that they took in for a semester. So I'm sure at the end of that, you feel like doing things to your body that would cause you to lay in the street.
Well, it's even worse than that, though. And so those exams they take, those are for naught, too, right?
Yes.
They're not... You know, they get marks on them, but it doesn't count toward a GPA or anything.
No.
It all comes down to after 3 years, you don suit with a white, if you're a guy, a white bow tie and what they call subfusc, which is an academic gown, but not the big flowy thing.
Mm-hmm. They show it in the movie. People will recognize it.
And you write your exams yet again, but this time it counts. If you don't get score above a 2 or whatever.
Cumulative for your 3 years.
Yeah. You're done.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
Can you imagine especially with the anxiety being so like a plague
it's supposed to be so strenuous that once you've gotten your BA, if you basically stay out of jail for 3 years and come back, they'll give you a master's.
I mean,
for being alive for 3 years without getting locked up.
We're not used to a system that was meant to filter people, right? Yeah. Like it was designed to allow people to fail. We're not used to that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know, my point in bringing up the beer and the evangelicals who filled two movie theaters is simply that they showed him drinking multiple times.
Yes.
Both as a Christian, smoking a pipe,
cigarettes. Slamming whiskey like it was iced tea.
Smoking cigarettes and communing at an Anglican church even if they didn't believe it or not, the liturgy saves them. And he literally has to say Christ for you twice.
Yeah.
In regards to the supper, right? I'm thinking about these evangelicals in here who have just had to have an encounter with who they thought was an evangelical, you know, born again Christian who is actually part of a Orthodox historic faith that doesn't nitpick at those things like drinking and smoking, and also participates in a real "This is the body and blood of Christ for you" supper at church.
And quotes that the biggest sin he ever committed was sinning against that body and blood of Christ
right.
in the supper by not recognizing it for what it was.
Right.
Yeah. Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Counterintuitive, probably, yeah, for a lot of people watching it.
And just a very, very meaningful scene. And that's that inning scene is where they switch to the sermon out of the Way to Glory, where he talks about not ever meeting in his entire life a mere mortal, because everybody that's been created in God's image is eternal.
Mm. Mm.
And that you bear the weight in your life of interacting with, in your everyday life, with eternal beings. And there's a weight to that comes through as you sort of reflect the glory of God given to you in Christ.
So
is weight of glory in God in the dock, or is it a separate?
I have a first edition. So
watch your cable. He's walking across the room, ladies and gentlemen.
But I will pull out God in the dock and confirm for you. But I have.
While he's doing that, I'll bring up interesting. So the title of the movie is "The Most Reluctant Convert," and they really do depict his reluctancy and the series of steps it took. Right. So, you know, sort of his fall into atheism, followed by the first step to coming back, is simply just rejecting materialism, not even rejecting it, but sort of being shook, having his materialism shook by the idea of his reason and consciousness not being material, right? His personhood kind of shakes him. He hadn't considered it. Am I just atoms? Are all my thoughts just random collisions, and is every other person just a meaningful random collision?
Yeah. It's like a contemporary materialist, Richard Dawkins, once referred to human beings as simply a ball of fizzing atoms.
Yeah, that's
how
right.
How bleak is that? Yeah. I mean, if it were fizzing true, it'd be atoms. Terribly bleak. But can you imagine? And so you think of what it would, if you're really committed to something like materialism, as Lewis was. And that was sort of if you're a man of science, you know, science broadly mm-hmm. conceived, you will be a materialist. That's the culture, right? It makes sense that it would have taken him a long time to get out of that, you know, and that it was, did you say incremental, I guess? Because he becomes what we could describe as a theist first, right? He recognizes there's something higher, something immaterial. There's no way to explain.
They even just said, like, I mean, the depiction was that before he's even a theist, he's just like accepting of non-physical things via his own human personhood. It's like, I exist as not atoms. And
that's right.
And it made him upset. Then they depict his becoming a theist very interestingly, which is they have the character set down a mirror in front of him.
Oh, yeah. He really does like second use
of
the law
stuff.
And he
says, I examined myself. And in front of this mirror, they have him discussing all his sins, finding all his shortcomings, that when he looked in the mirror, he saw a cynic, he saw somebody self-conceited, somebody prideful, somebody lustful, and that the name of his sins are legion, right? But that he hadn't become a Christian yet, that the law had revealed to him God, and that in that moment he had become a theist, but he was not a Christian. And so God was revealed in his sin and in the law, but which God had not yet been found. And that isn't, you know, this is one of those opportunities where Lutherans could be like, see, Lewis got law and gospel distinction. Well, he probably didn't get it. It got him is the thing.
That's a good way to say that.
He doesn't really ever explain that in his writings, but it certainly took hold of him. And what we can see there is the law and the hidden God shredding him to pieces. He had not yet had a savior.
Mm-hmm. The case for Christianity, the first part, the first third, I guess it is, of mere Christianity, when he makes he's making his famous apologetic for, first it starts with kind of a theistic apologetic, but he stops for a moment almost and says, just because you've convinced somebody or you're convinced that a God exists doesn't mean you're anywhere close to Christianity. It's when you
That's right.
when you recognize that you are I guess, out of relationship, or if you've done things that are an affront to
the moral lawgiver. I think he does use out of relationship. I think that's actually accurate language. Yeah.
And but once you realize that, once it becomes personal and relational, if you will, to use an overused word, but that's when Christianity finally begins to talk, and it talks through Jesus.
Yeah, that's what we would need to assert, right? Is that if you're out of relation, the question is, how can you know what that God wants?
Well, that's his point. His point in using that language, mm-hmm. is that, you know, you can know a couple things from sort of natural law, and I've said it before that Lewis goes as far as I think you can go, but you can know a couple things. You can know sort of God's general right and wrong, righteous requirements, you might say, in a general way, right? Mm-hmm. Don't steal, don't murder, kind of like second table of the law type stuff. But the other thing you can know is that the out of relationship part is that when the good is described of fulfilling that natural law, that second table of law stuff, it's not describing you.
Yeah. They used the words in the movie, God has an impossible standard.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Right. And that's very important in sort of a Christian confession of the law, is that it is an impossible standard, and it is not going to be the key to finding that relationship. And ultimately, it's going to be, in order to see that relationship or even have it, that God finally has to speak.
Yeah.
Right. Or else you'll never know if you have it or you don't. God can't be silent. And that is when the depiction of his friends finally sort of starts to come into the movie, right? Is he's a theist now, but God is silent, and it's his friends who are going to speak Christ to him. And through his friends, like Tolkien and Barfield and his brother, Christ is going to actually speak.
Right. No, Way to Glory is not in God in the Dock. There are a couple highly recommended essays, I'd say, in God in the Dock, though, just to throw a few at people. His essay on the humanitarian theory of punishment is amazing, and it's totally for our age, something that should be read. If people remember the Christmas wars of a few years ago, like Xmas versus Christmas, there's literally an essay in God on the Dock that's called Xmas and Christmas that people should maybe read for sort of a different perspective on that type of thing. But in Weight of Glory, the book, the first chapter beyond sort of the introduction is literally called Weight of Glory. A couple of really meaningful chapters in here are on forgiveness, and A Slip of the Tongue, which are the two final chapters, which if you're not going to read the whole book or listen to the whole book on Audible or whatever, I'd highly recommend those two. You guys are lucky that basically the only theology shelf I have in my office is my C.S. Lewis shelf.
Yeah, that is interesting. Everything else is over at the cabin, huh?
Yeah, in the confession shelf.
Yeah. So what this shows you is if you can, in fact, have more than a whole shelf of Lewis if one so desires.
It's a 5-foot shelf.
Yeah, yeah. That's not bad.
The whole thing? C.S. Lewis?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple Inklings books
Two-thirds
that I see.
Two-thirds of it is Lewis, and then the last third are biographies.
Yeah. It's not bad, though.
He was prolific. The thing that's amazing
I don't even have everything. Every time I think I have everything. But Macmillan, like, changes the title so often, it's hard to keep up.
They want to sell books, man. Yeah. Well, we are pretty close to our usual 40-minute mark, and this allows us an opportunity for a second episode on Lewis, I think, where we dive into works and his character and reputation a little bit more. I mean, it is interesting because he's been popular for so long, right? Lewis is often characterized as somebody who's was such a dynamic lecturer that, you know, people who didn't even have his classes, you know, would come and show up. Right, or
that's very common at Oxford, by the way. So that's kind of how it works there. So lectures are offered,
but like filled in comparison to other Inklings, Tolkien, who classically would like speak to one or two people. Which there are definitely some dynamics to explore with that. With Lewis' popularity as a speaker and as a teacher, and then later after his life, like you said, Adam, in the U.S. in particular and amongst evangelicals, is sort of like this inspirational conversion story, and then also, I think in a lot of regards, this safe media, this safe fairy tale for our children type of thing. And that's, you know, it being safe isn't the initial intention. It's actually it communicating Christianity in story is the intention. So overall, great movie and a great bouncing point to sort of talk about his life biographically. And then I think from here we can talk about the sort of the scope of his works more.
You know, if we had the time, if Adam has the time to record more, I actually think it'd be kind of fun to do like maybe an episode on Surprised by Joy, maybe an episode on The Problem of Pain, and maybe an episode on The Way to Glory, or maybe you could probably do Problem of Pain and Way to Glory in one episode. But
yeah,
I mean, it might take a quick reread for us, but they're not difficult reads.
No, they're not difficult reads. I think we could definitely do that. We can focus on various groupings of the books. And then I do think I do want to get to the Inklings and Tolkien as a general overview, too.
Yeah, well, I love Inklings as a topic. I mean, when Adam said,
"That's what I want."
I want that. Yeah, I mean, we used to try to do that more, but everybody moved. So
everybody moved. And by everybody, we mean you, Adam.
I mean, I'm dead serious. I remember how I felt after that, because I remember we went to that Belgium restaurant afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, that has the oysters Brussels. And French fries, basically.
Mm. Brussels, yeah.
And just thinking, oh, we got to do this more often, you know.
Yeah.
And, it's interesting when you, at the very beginning when we started talking, you talked about how these friends, they were very serious with each other. You know, they would call each other on their own bluff or on their bluff. And I think that's the right way of saying it. But that's kind of the way you are, Scott.
Caleb told me on the way home.
Yeah. I mean, you call out what we might call
BS.
BS. And of course, by that, we mean
I cussed on the last episode, so we can't cuss
before
on this
studying.
One.
You know, you've arrived at a position before studying it, so it's BS. But that's, the Inklings, that's a fantastic topic. If we do that, maybe we should toast.
And I think
over Zoom.
We should.
You know, a little toast.
Well, and it's a great topic, too, because what that doesn't mean is sort of like expertism, that only somebody degreed or in a field can speak. It's actually sort of saying that every person has the power to speak in an educated manner on topics that they care about. It's whether they've put in that effort and that work to be able to have an educated opinion on it, not whether they have a degree or a certificate in that subject matter. And so it's actually about being educated in education and not education in sort of like, oh, I want to be a teacher at school, in your own self-education. And we're used to this today. How many times can you hear you shouldn't say anything, you're not a scientist, right?
Yeah.
Are scientists the only people who can make logical conclusions by looking and analyzing data?
No, they're not. All right. Some other people are trained in research, too.
Yeah.
That was funny. Caleb said that same thing to me on the way home because I was talking about the Great Knock and how important it was. He's like,
well, that's what you did.
He goes, that's what you do. And I started thinking about it because that day he had brought his kids over to help me wash the car. And my 4-year-old grandson comes over and goes, and it's like 63 outside. He goes, it's a hot day today. And I go, what makes you say it's a hot day today? I think most people would say it's a nice day today. And he goes, well, it is a nice day today, but it's kind of hot. And I go, are you saying that it's hotter than it has been the past couple of weeks? And he goes, yeah, it's been cold the past couple of weeks. I'm like, okay.
Beautiful. Is the Great Knock the inspiration for the professor in the Chronicles of Narnia?
I think so. And the house is his house. His new house, as the kids called it, is the inspiration for the mansion that is breezy and long open hallways and books everywhere and secret closets and
well, there was an actual wardrobe that he and Warnie would play in. Yeah. So
you could
there's a lot of truth in there.
Speaking of Lewis's house, not the house I think you're referring to, but when you go to Oxford, you can go visit where he lived when he lived in Oxford, the kilns.
The kilns, yeah. I believe Caleb has a fountain pen made from wood from a tree from the kilns.
I do, yeah.
That's Steve Mueller
made. Steve Mueller made that, who's another Lewis buff. And we thought it might be possible to get him on the show to talk about.
It would be. I emailed him. I have his book on Lewis.
Actually, I stole it. It's actually at my house, so it's not on the shelf. There's a gap right there, and that's where the book belongs.
Okay. One more bit of trivia is, well, two. One, if you're ever in Chicago area, if you come to Wheaton College has a museum dedicated to C.S. Lewis. Second thing I just learned the other
Didn't
day.
Did they receive his library, too?
I think so, yeah. The second thing I just learned the other day is that in Westminster Abbey, there's a place called, what do they call it, Poets Corner, I think, where Geoffrey Chaucer is laid to rest there, and there's all these plaques commemorating the great, you know, the greats, if you will, in the English tradition. And very recently, as of a couple of years ago, they put a plaque of C.S. Lewis in there. So he's he's becoming a kind of a national.
That's awesome.
Not hero, but I don't know what you'd call it.
Yeah.
Hey. I know that on this episode, we probably have a lot of new listeners and first-time listeners to the show. So we appreciate your time. We hope this conversation has been interesting to you. To longtime listeners and people who have requested that we do this, sorry it took so long, but I really did want to have a substantial part of the original cast back in order to do that. And I think this series will be an excellent break as we wait to get back into the Lutheran Confessions. If you're joining us for this, we are going to do this for the next several weeks, probably up into the month of December, and we greatly appreciate your support and listening. We are coming up on our end-of-year giving campaigns. Thinking Fellows is unique as a podcast, as are all of the podcasts on the 1517 Podcast Network. As if you were listening to this, we didn't insert any ads in. We don't sell you razors. We don't sell you cooking subscriptions or website building tools.
Coffee.
Or the whole thing. Instead, we just try to give you a interruption-free conversation. And the way we do that is by having listeners who support us financially. You can go to 1517.org/donate to support the show, to support 1517 and our podcasting efforts as we move into 2022. Thank you for listening. We will catch you next time. Bye.